and welcome to Season 8, Episode 5 of the Ubuntu Podcast. It's Tuesday, the 7th of April, and today we're going to discuss what's been happening in the news. And today I'm joined by Mark. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm not too bad, thank you. Lovely and worn out after my bank holiday weekend.
Super. And Martin is back. Hello, Martin. How are you?
Hiya. Homage to Laura there.
Oh, it's just not the same.
Yes.
No, sorry. I can't do it.
Sadly, Laura can't be with us this week or next week. So, once again, Martin did a sterling job last time. So, he's come back to join us for another couple of episodes.
Yes, indeed.
Shall we get on with it?
Oh, why not?
All right.
And now it's time for the news. And first up in the news this week, GitHub, the popular open source code hosting site, has suffered a sustained distributed denial of service attack in the last week, lasting from the 26th to the 31st of March. GitHub's status page, which has a sort of scrolling message telling you how GitHub's getting on, posted regular updates to their as the attack and their mitigation efforts progressed. And after 113 hours of sustained attacks, the mitigation efforts overcame the issue and normal service was resumed.
So, obviously, you know, there's a number of questions here. One, why do people do this?
Yeah.
And why GitHub? Of anyone?
The attacks were aimed at, I believe, a particular repository. There was basically a bit of malware injected into some websites which requested over and over again pages from a project called Great Fire, which is an anti-surveillance and censorship software, as in Great Firewall. And it's been widely reported the Chinese government may be responsible, as is often rumoured with these sorts of things.
Mm, it's interesting, isn't it? Because GitHub's sort of probably one of the greatest expressions, sort of free software expressions on the internet. And a oppressive regime has decided to try and silence the whole of GitHub for one project that they find disagreeable.
I do like that it's the expression of free software, but the software that runs GitHub isn't free software.
Well, ooh. Yeah.
Well, you know, I could say that now. Launchpad is free software. I can get away with that. This has obviously, you know, caused trouble for developers, you know, who use GitHub. And what do people do to work around this? You know, obviously all their code is in GitHub, but they all have, you know, if you're multiple developers on a team, you're all got your own local copy, so you can carry on working.
Well, yeah,
I'm sure everyone doesn't just disconnect and, you know, go and play golf. I'm sure there's other options.
That's the great thing about Git being a distributed system. Just because the GitHub repository is down doesn't mean that you can't, you know, just set up another server and all push and pull from that. And then, a lot of the time in an organization, you'll have an internal Git repository and then just push your public stuff to GitHub, I suppose, rather than doing all your development.
Unless
there.
You're an open source company.
I think a lot of people rely on that. Oh, well, all of our developers have got checkouts of Git on their machines, and that's our backup strategy. But that's only half the story, because you'll have different developers with different local branches. And actually, if you needed to, if GitHub went away, merging all of that stuff back and making a new repository would be a bit of a pain. And there are scripts, and so also GitHub's more than just the source code. You know, there's also the issues and the wikis and the other features of GitHub that people use. So if you're using GitHub, my advice would be to go and look at one of the scripts that can do a full backup of your Git organization or your individual Git account and your projects, and run that. So let's hope the day doesn't come, but if GitHub was to suffer some catastrophic failure, you've actually got an up-to-the-minute export of all of your code using Git fetch rather than a clone or a mirror, and all of the issue tracker and wiki documents that go with it.
Right. So is all the issue tracker, like, I know all the wiki pages are managed through Git, or can be managed through Git, so can the issue pages issues be managed through Git as well?
They're not Git managed, no. But there are APIs to manipulate large parts of Git, large parts of GitHub. So you can extract the data, and there are some nice convenient scripts that automate a lot of that for
you. And given that what Alan was just saying about the fact that GitHub isn't actually open source itself, is there what can you then do with that if you've got a dump of all of your GitHub issues? Can you put it in something like GitLab?
Well, once you've got it, I forget what format they're in. I don't know if they're in JSON, but they're in some, you know, passable format that, you know, if you needed to, you could definitely find a way to put them into something else.
Cool. Mm. What's next, Alan?
In Google News, the Google security blog has posted an article about their upcoming crackdown on ad injector software, which inserts additional adverts into otherwise clean web pages for some value of clean. The article discusses the problem of ad injectors and makes it clear that they're not part of a healthy ad ecosystem and they're not compatible with the AdWords guidelines. AdWords customers also received emails recently updating the guidelines for software adverts to crack down on malicious parties adding fake download links in adverts. So what are ad injectors then?
So this is like basically where you have a piece of malware like running on your, usually, you know, might have come pre-installed
on your Lenovo laptop.
On your Lenovo laptop, or, you know, you might have downloaded Bonsai Buddy and it installed a load of stuff in the background. Am I the only one who remembers Bonsai Buddy?
The name is familiar, but I don't remember what it was.
It was a little purple monkey and installed loads of spyware. So then you load up a web page and this bit of software running in the background hooks into your browser and then plasters your page with ads based on other stuff that's in the web page.
Yeah.
And they can be like, they can basically just be embedding some Google ads and Google doesn't like you doing that, understandably, because it gives them a bad name.
So Superfish made all the news recently, with it being included in a bunch of Lenovo machines. And I use some software called like Awesome Screenshot Capture or something like that. It's a plugin for Firefox. And it stopped working the other day and I was digging around in the options and I found the checkbox, which is Enable Superfish.
Ugh.
So that plugin got hurriedly removed from my machine. Nice. So this stuff can crop up in all sorts of places. So be vigilant because I hadn't spotted it prior to then.
And that's on your Linux machine.
It's a Firefox plugin on my Linux machine.
Because you know, we've always been saying, you know, I look back to the days when I used to have to support a friend's Windows machine where, you know, that it was laden with all these things that, and now I don't have to worry about that so much. I have other things to worry about, of course, but, you know, I don't have that to worry about. But it seems like we're starting to get to the point where, plugins and other things people may install to make them more productive or make the machine more useful will have these kind of things in there. Because, you know, Chromebook, for example, being a number one selling laptop, people are going to target Chrome and Chrome extensions, especially popular ones like taking screenshots. That makes total sense. You know, you can see the value for them.
Mm.
What's next, Wimpy?
Okay. Barack Obama declared a national emergency in the US on the 1st of April, issuing an executive order entitled Blocking the Property of Certain Persons Engaging in Significant Malicious Cyber-Enabled Activities. Ooh, that's catchy. One who came up with that one. One Redditor posted an analysis of the order on the Bitcoin subreddit, suggesting that it makes donating funds to Edward Snowden illegal in the US and allows the government to seize your property if you do so. Wow.
Nice.
Land of the free.
Yes. Yeah, it was a bit weird, like, when I saw the link to it, and the first thing I saw was 1st of April, I thought, this is an April Fool's joke, and then I read the words, this is a national emergency, and thought, maybe he's not messing about. But it does seem odd, the kind of things that they can declare a national emergency for.
Yes, it does seem.
It does.
Emergency. Yeah. You know, change the colour of the bulb and all that. I've seen, you know, people who have been quite vocal about donating to Snowden and WikiLeaks and other, you know, other activism organisations. And, you know, should people start being worried about, you know, where they give their money to? Are you supposed to not give your money to, I don't know, Greenpeace or the Green Party or, you know, some of these for fear that the government might one day say that's an outlawed organisation? I mean, I can understand not wanting people to go to Syria to fight, and I can understand not wanting your citizens to donate to ISIS. But trying to, you know, determine who in the future will be one of those banned organizations.
Yeah.
It could be a fraught somewhat.
One man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter and all that. Yeah,
exactly. Ugh.
But that's not all that Edward Snowden has been in the news for, is it?
No, rather brilliantly, three artists installed a 4-foot, 100-pound sculpture of Edward Snowden into one of the parks in New York, and city workers were then summoned to come and remove it. And I just think that's absolutely fabulous.
To be clear, you said it's a 4-foot sculpture. It's just a bust, isn't it? It's not a bust, midget size.
Short Edward Snowden.
Yeah, it's not a mini me. No, it's a 4-foot bust. But that story really tickled me as a backdrop to this other story. I thought that was brilliant, and it's a shame. I mean, why couldn't they have left it? I mean,
it is interesting, you know, the sort of dichotomy there between the sort of, you know, the state declaring him basically an enemy combatant, essentially, and saying that if you support him, you're an enemy of the state. And then, you know, some of the people saying, well, actually, we want a statue of him in our city.
Mm. Right. It's no different. It's no different than Nelson Mandela, you know, from 30 years ago, or however long ago,
it's
you have two differing opinions, and this will shake out in 20, 30 years. I would be surprised if Snowden leaves Russia in my lifetime. Maybe 20 or 30 years time, I'll be reading a paper and there'll be some story about him. I would not be surprised if his name fades in 10 years time, and then in 30 years time it comes back as he's made his way out because there's some new progressive government in the US or some other country that accept him and things have changed. But I, you know, depressing as it is, I can't see him getting home anytime.
No.
You know,
and what I find upsetting about this is that he risked so much and has sacrificed so much, and all of my family know who Edward Snowden is and the nature of what it is he leaked and reported. But despite that, outside of the circles of sort of super technical and super motivated, people aren't really changing their habits at all. And the cat is really out of the bag now. And that's a real, real disappointment.
Right. And in fact, a lot of people don't know who Snowden is. I mean, you say your family know who he is. Mine do. But that's, you know, because of the job we do and the interest we take in these things. John Oliver has a TV show on in the States, and over the weekend they aired an interview he did with Snowden, and they showed footage of him talking to, John Oliver talking to people in the street, and they have no idea, you know, a significant chunk of them have no idea who Edward Snowden is. So, you know, there's certainly going to be some people that you could have walked up to in South Africa and said, who is this guy? And they might not have known who Mandela was at that time. Maybe, you know, it will become more clear later on. Who knows?
Let's hope so.
But I think he'll still be in the news for the next, you know, for the rest of our podcast season. So, you know, we're okay. All right. Moving on.
Great. Microsoft has announced that, following a lengthy battle with the UK government, it will be adding ODF support to its Office 365 product in the next update. Move comes after the UK government adopted ODF as the standard for sharing documents, following a public consultation in which Microsoft attempted to argue that its own Office Open XML was a preferable standard.
Well, fancy that. It's, you know, I think it's the worm has turned. Times are changing inside Microsoft. It's taken a while, and it's taken a change of leadership. But I think their leadership is making an effect, a good effect, that, you know, they're maybe becoming more open, maybe willing to change and willing to adopt standards that they didn't invent.
Maybe open sourcing Windows.
Yeah, that perennial one came up again. This week.
Yeah.
It is like the only thing that I find a bit of a shame about this story is, you know, when it was announced that the government was going to move to open formats, there was sort of the whole, oh yeah, that means that everyone's going to use LibreOffice and more open source and stuff. But no, Microsoft will just build it into their proprietary stuff, and everyone will keep buying their stuff.
You say that, but there is one word conspicuous by its absence in this little summary.
Go on.
And it says that Microsoft will be adding ODF support to its Office 365 product. It doesn't say we'll be adding compatible ODF support to its Office 365 product. So it remains to be seen whether this is actually a usable alternative, because in most cases at the moment, if you are looking for decent ODF support, Microsoft point you at a GitHub repository, which is not precisely user-friendly for their target audience, and also inaccessible for parts of this month, as it turns out.
Ah, yes. Right. Well, I think that's all we've got time for in the news this week. Unless there's one other final tiny little thing to fit in.
Micro story. There's a Kickstarter campaign for a small wearable programmable device with an LED matrix. Basically,
we spoke about this last week, didn't we?
It's similar to the BBC-sponsored micro bit that we talked about last week. It's £12 on Kickstarter, and it's called a Code Bug.
Right.
Yeah. When does the campaign finish?
Remarkably similar to the micro bit.
Yes, it's very similar, isn't it?
I wonder if they were
inspired.
or whether it's an actual product that's related, or a project that's related to what the BBC were planning.
It's pretty rapidly turned around. If it is.
Is the micro bit open hardware?
No, I don't think it is.
No.
Is this open hardware?
I don't see an open hardware logo on it.
Okay.
Oh, it says it's Creative Commons too, so that's good.
Cool.
And I think that's all for the news this week.
Lovely. And now we have some Chrome news. So there's a couple of stories which came up this week, which we thought we'd delve into in a bit more depth regarding sort of maybe the general direction that Chrome OS is going to be going in beyond the Chromebooks, which we discussed last week. So first up, there's this this device which is being made by Asus called the Chromebit. This is kind of like a Well, you've seen these HDMI sticks which go in the back of your TV running Android. They've been around for a while. This is one like those running Chrome OS, but it's got a similar sort of spec to Asus have another device called the Chromebook Flip, which is a Chromebook, obviously, which has, you know, a decent amount of RAM for a Chromebook and so on. And this is exactly the same spec as that, but you use your TV for a screen, and it's got a USB port to plug in a input devices and so on, and uses USB for power.
So it's 2 gig of RAM, a Rockchip SoC, so that'll be ARM based, and 16 gig of eMMC flash storage inside a thing like the size of a bit bigger than a Chromecast, a big USB stick. Yeah, chocolate bars. There we go. KitKat, I think. A 2-bar KitKat, I'd say.
Okay.
And it's going to be, what, $100 or so going on sale in summer? Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting device. I would love more of these things that were more open to be flashable. I don't know whether Google have backed this in terms of financially, sponsored it in some way so that to offset the cost to Asus. In some way, the fact that it's got Google backing and it's got the Chrome logo on it means that it will sell loads anyway. Whereas, you know how the PC market is full of loads of different devices, loads of different notebooks, loads of different desktops. Whereas, Chromebooks, there's a limited supply of them. They're all very similar kind of specs. There are variations of resolution and memory and storage and stuff, but there's not a huge number of them. Whereas these, they're so small and tiny and could be cranked out in the bazillion that everyone could have one on their desk and could run anything. The Intel one, what's it called? The Intel
now we're talking.
Compute Stick.
Yeah.
Their variant
that does look interesting.
Has a Windows version and a standard Linux version as opposed to a Chrome version. And if the cost comes down, then these can be, you know, very simple computing devices, universal computing devices, not just, you know, tied to using Chrome.
And therein lies the rub, because, you know, the geek in me looks at this Asus Chrome bit and I immediately think, oh, yes, it's small and it's got all the specs I need. You know, it's got 2 gigs of RAM. It's got a sensible amount of storage, you know, for a small device. Price is nice, $100. Well, that's 100 quid, so it's more like $160 if you're in the UK. But, you know, you have to jump through hoops to install Linux on it if you want to do that. But I'm sure in time we'll be able to do all of that stuff. So, you know, the hacker and the tinkerer in me wants to get one of these and have a play with it. And then you look at the Intel compute stick and you think, brilliant. Now, there's a device I don't have to hack or fiddle with. And it's $10 less. It's $89. But the rub is that I imagine through the, you know, the OEM agreements with Microsoft, the Linux version has only got a gig of RAM and has only got 8 gigs of storage as opposed to, I think, 32 in the Windows version, which is $50
more. It's interesting you say that, because in all the stories that I've seen in the last week, they've all shown them with the same spec. And in the past, when they first announced them, the Linux version and the Windows version, yes, were different specs and were different price points. But Newegg have it on their website, and both of them have the same spec. And
wow. Oh, well, I hope that's so the case. You're definitely reading a more optimistic brand of news than I am, because
I'm reading all the ones that are wrong.
Was reporting. Well, let's hope that your optimistic spin on the news is how it's going to be, because I hate the fact that, you know, somehow because it's Linux, you can do with less. You know, when you can do so much with Linux, why should we have to get by with less? Why can't we have as much or more than our competitors? I hate the fact that, you know, not just Microsoft, but, and more so now, you know, Google have got their, you know, their partnership power and their purchasing power. And they're able to sort of close the hobbyists out of the game with something equivalent.
Mm-hmm. So similarly, I got an email notification this week about the Mozilla Matchstick. Do you remember the Firefox running USB stick?
I'm a backer for that.
So am I. And I got the email this week saying, you know, things are still happening. Yeah, we haven't forgotten about this, but basically we're completely re-engineering the whole project and it's going to be a different device and you'll get it in August. And they were supposed to be shipping in February this year. So I think part of the problem is that, yes, these companies like Microsoft and Google and Intel have huge resources in order to make these things and build partnerships with companies like Asus to spin up a plant to churn out a bazillion of these things that they can sell almost at cost. Whereas, you know, the hobbyist market have to make do with, you know, Kickstarter campaigns that may or may not work, devices that may or may not have free software drivers, so might not actually appeal to some of those people who would be interested in those kind of devices, and which may not even get supported beyond, you know, a year or more. So I can see why people like look at the hacker type devices and then say, well, I've got more confidence that the Chrome bit thing is actually going to work, or the Intel device is going to work. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. I'll tell you something that made me think when I saw the picture of this Chrome bit. Does the HDMI standard specify a maximum weight that the port is supposed to be able to support? Because some of these things are getting pretty big.
Well, they mostly come with an extended cable.
That's a really good point.
The Chromecast does. You get a little 3-inch cable, so you're not actually putting pressure, but also if your HDMI port is in an awkward
place. I can see a lot of people just jamming them straight into the port and ending up with either a bent stick or a bent port as a result.
People aren't being sold the dream of plugging their Chromecast or their Chrome bit in with a bit of dangly cable. They're thinking, just plug it in.
You're quite right.
It does mean also you've got to have your TV increasingly further away from the wall.
Yeah.
my father-in-law has a Chromecast. After he saw mine, he bought one. And the HDMI ports on his TV are on the side. So actually his Chromecast sticks out into the room on the side of his TV.
Great.
So, you know, I said to him, you should use the little extendy cable. But then when you do that, it sticks out even further into the room. So, Yeah, I don't think there's an optimal solution for that. Maybe we need right-angled HDMI cables. That's what we need.
Oh, you can get those. Oh,
there you go. I'll get one of those. So this was Google News or Chrome News. Mark, was there another piece of Chrome News?
There was, yes, another piece of Chrome News. So, yeah, this kind of makes me think a bit about how Chrome OS could be used. Google have announced the Android runtime for Chrome, or Arc, which will allow any developer to port their Android app to Chrome OS. So there's already loads. I mean, there's quite a lot of Chrome apps, but there are loads of Android apps out there. And this is going to allow essentially anyone running Chrome OS to be able to install an app which has already been written into Android and run it in their Chrome environment.
Well, that's good for touchscreen apps, surely, and especially apps that, touchscreen Chromebooks or laptops running Chrome, because...
I think you'd be surprised, because I've got Android x86 running on a Dell Mini 9 that I retrofitted a touchscreen on. And actually, you can use that fairly effectively just with the mouse and, you know, mouse buttons. You don't need touch the screen to make it go. It's remarkably usable.
Right.
I can think more so with an app, you know.
Well, I have the same on a Toshiba AC100 that doesn't have a touch screen. But I was thinking more of the apps that people might bring to Chrome using Arc or ARC or whatever it is. Many of them assume that it's a touch screen because the primary platform was tablets and phones. So they might have to do a bit of rework to make it work.
So you're thinking gestures,
multi-touch, rotation.
Multi-touch, good point.
So, you know, anything. That's why, I mean, something like the Chrome Pixel, which has a touch screen, or indeed a PC laptop. Does it specify whether this is going to work in Chrome on other OSs
it doesn't say whether it's going to work in Chrome the browser in Chrome I don't OS. Think
I think that's what they're saying. Chrome OS but yeah.
Because I don't know, I think they've got some extra they call it app runtime for Chrome,
right? So the secret sauce,
test your app
there.
You need your APK, PC, Mac, Linux or Chromebook on Chrome version 41 plus. No, it sounds like you do just need a modern version of Chrome.
Yeah, it seems to support, you know, native clients, so maybe it could be made to go.
Yeah, so and Chromium then, presumably.
Well, I was going to say, if it requires Chrome, you can bet your life somebody's going to rip the necessary gubbins out and make it available as a Chrome, you know, feature. I'm sure that'll happen. But not all the services, not all the Google Play services are supported yet. So, you know, there are some things that work nicely and some things that don't. But you'll be pleased to hear that ads are fully supported in this initial version.
Yes. Phew.
But not ads injected with an ad injector.
No,
only legitimate, you know, non-intrusive ads.
It's funny, I started playing a game on Android yesterday that I saw was in the top 10 apps on Android. And I sometimes rummage through the top 10 apps just to see what's popular. I downloaded this app, and they have a cunning way of getting you to watch ads. While you're playing the game, there's no ads on screen, but then your character gets an email where it says, if you watch an ad, or if you let us put ads on the screen for 30 seconds, at the bottom of the screen for 30 seconds, we reward you with something, some tokens or whatever in the game. And so you can either say yes or no, and if you say no, obviously you don't see the advert, but you don't get the reward. So you actually get more of a choice then of whether you're going to see adverts or not. But that obviously influences your progression in the game. But I thought that was a much better way than just always having a banner at the bottom of the screen and you always having to avoid
pressing
it.
Whenever you die, it displays an ad on the screen and you have to get rid of it, and then you end up pressing the link to go to the website.
Yeah. And that's more of a concern when you've got children.
Yes.
Absolutely. Is that the end of the...
It's nice to see...
Sorry, go on.
It's nice to see Google and Chrome OS embracing the convergence story.
Like everyone else, like we've been telling you all forever. I think that's the end of the Chrome News.
Yeah, that's the end of Chrome News.
Well, that's all for episode 5, and we'll be back next week when we'll be discussing something, and maybe some GUI love.
I think we'll probably have command line love, and maybe we'll discuss hardware you can buy running
Linux.
That
sounds like a good idea.
Oh, that's a good topic. Yes.
Yeah, let's do that.
So thank you once again, cool. Martin, for joining us this week, and we'll see you again.
And indeed next week.
See you next Thank week.
You. If anyone yes. has any feedback for us, details are all on the website. Or you can email us show@ubuntupodcast.org. Cheerio.
Bye-bye.
Bye.